Now I commend you for remembering me in all things and firmly adhering to the traditions, just as I conveyed them to you. After finishing the discussion about the idol sacrifices as appropriately as he could, and making it thoroughly perfect in all aspects, he moves on to another issue, which was also a complaint, but not as serious. I said earlier, I say again now, that he doesn't list all the severe allegations consecutively. After sorting them out properly, he includes the less serious matters among them, lessening the offensive impact his discourse might cause to the readers due to his constant reprimanding. Therefore, he also saved the most serious allusion for last, that of the resurrection. But for now, he transitions to a lighter point, saying, "Now I commend you for remembering me in all things." When the wrongdoing is undeniable, he openly criticizes and warns, but when it is disputable, he substantiates it first, then reproaches. He amplifies what was undeniable, but concedes what was potentially contentious. Their sin of fornication, for example, was undeniable. Therefore, there was no need to demonstrate that an offense had taken place. But regarding this, he highlighted the gravity of the transgression and structured his argument around comparison. Their taking of legal disputes before outsiders was an offense, though not as grave. Consequently, he reflects upon this and substantiates it. The issue of idol sacrifices was contentious, yet it was a very severe evil. Hence, he not only highlights it as an offense, but also emphasizes it through his discussion. However, while doing this, he does more than just dissuade them from these specific wrongs, he also encourages them to their opposites. For instance, he didn't only state that one should not sin with fornication, but also that one should demonstrate extraordinary holiness. Hence, he added, "Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit." Moreover, having asserted that one should not be wise with the kind of wisdom that is superficial, he is not content with just this, but prompts him also to become a fool. And when he advises them against taking disputes before outsiders and to avoid wrong, he goes further. He obviates even the prospect of litigation, counseling them not only to avoid wrong, but even to endure it. And discussing about the idol sacrifices, he didn't simply say that one should refrain from forbidden things only, but also from permitted things if they cause offense, and not only to avoid hurting the brethren, but not even Greeks or Jews. Accordingly, he states, "Don't cause any stumbling block for either Jews or Greeks or the Church of God." Therefore, after he finished discussing all these matters, he moved on to another criticism. And what might that be? Their women used to pray and prophesy with uncovered heads, while the men would keep long hairstyles as if they were philosophers and would cover their heads while praying or prophesying, which were Greek traditions. He had previously advised them about these inappropriate behaviors when he was with them, and some complied while others did not. Hence, in his letter too, he carefully addressed these issues, similar to a physician applying medicine to a wound, thus correcting the offense. It's clear that he had previously counseled them in person, as is evident in the way he initiated the topic. Why else, having not mentioned this matter anywhere in the letter before and moving on from other criticisms, would he say, "Now I praise you because you remember me in all things and hold firmly to the traditions, exactly as I passed them on to you. You see that some obeyed, whom he praises, and others disobeyed, whom he corrects by what follows, saying, 'Now if any man appears to be argumentative, we have no such tradition.' Because if, after some did well and others disobeyed, he had included all in his criticism, he would have both emboldened the first group and made the latter more negligent. However, now by praising and endorsing the first and reproaching the other, he both invigorates the first more effectively and makes the other more intimidated by him. The criticism alone was enough to wound them, but now that it is compared to others who have done well and are praised, it pierces with a sharper sting. However, at the moment he begins not with criticism, but with commendations and great commendations, saying, 'Now I praise you for remembering me in all things.' For this is Paul's trait. Even for minor matters he crafts high praise, and not because he seeks to flatter, far from it. How could he do so when he values neither money nor glory nor any other such thing? Instead, he arranges all his actions for their salvation. And this is why he emphasizes the praise, saying, Now I praise you for remembering me in all things.
About what things? Until now, his discussion was only about them not having long hair and not covering their heads. But, as I mentioned, he is very generous in his compliments, making them more eager. That's why he says,
You remember me in everything, and adhere firmly to the traditions just as I gave them to you. It seems that he also shared many things not put into writing, which he also indicates in numerous other places. But back then he simply shared them, now he provides their meaning. In doing so, he not only strengthens the steadfast ones who obey, but also humbles those who oppose themselves. Furthermore, he doesn't explicitly say, You obeyed while others did not, but subtly suggests it through his teaching method in the following part where he says, But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of every woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. This is his explanation for the matter, and he presents it to engage the less attentive. Truly, someone who is faithful as they should be and steadfast doesn't need any reason or cause for commands given to them. They're satisfied with the rule alone. But when someone who is less strong also understands the reason, they both remember and comply more eagerly. Therefore, he did not state the reason until he saw the commandment being violated. So what is the reason? The head of every man is Christ. Is he then the head of the non-believer too? Certainly not. For if we are the body of Christ and individually members of it, and in this way he is our head, he cannot be the head of those who are not in the body and do not count among the members. So when he says, of every man, one must understand it of the believer. Do you see how he continually appeals to the listener's sense of shame by arguing from a higher level? Thus, whether he was speaking about love or humility or almsgiving, it was from these high principles that he drew his examples. But the leader of the woman is the man, and the leader of Christ is God. Now, skeptics attack us with a certain declaration of inferiority which they derive from these words against the Son, but they trip over their own views. For if the man is the leader of the woman, and the leader is of the same essence as the body, and the leader of Christ is God, then the Son is of the same essence as the Father. No, they argue, we don't mean to show that he is of another essence, but rather that he is under control. So how should we respond to this? First off, when anything humble is said about him, as he is united with the flesh, it doesn't degrade the divine nature in what is said, due to the acceptance of the role. But still, how do you plan to prove this from the passage? Just as the man rules over the woman, they claim, so does the Father over Christ. Therefore, as Christ governs the man, so does the Father over the Son. For the leader of every man, we read, is Christ. And who would ever agree to this? For if the Son's superiority to us is the standard for the Father's superiority to the Son, consider to what lowliness you'll reduce him. Hence, we shouldn't judge all things based on ourselves and God, even if the language used about them is similar. Instead, we should assign to God a certain unique excellence, as much as is appropriate to God. Otherwise, many absurdities will follow. As such, the leader of Christ is God, and Christ is the leader of the man, and he of the woman. Therefore, if we choose to take the term leader in the same sense in all the clauses, the Son will be as distant from the Father as we are from him. Indeed, the woman will be as distant from us as we are from the Word of God. And what the Son is to the Father, this we are to the Son, and the woman is to the man. And who would accept this?
But do you interpret the term head differently when it refers to man and woman compared to when it refers to Christ? If so, should we also interpret it differently in the case of the Father and the Son? In what way interpret it differently, you might ask, depending on the situation? For if Paul intended to discuss authority and submission, as you suggest, he wouldn't have used the example of a wife, but rather that of a slave and a master. Because even if the wife is subject to us, she is still a wife, free and equal in honor. And the Son, even though he became obedient to the Father, it was as the Son of God, as God himself. Because the Son's obedience to the Father is greater than we see in humans toward their parents, so too his freedom is greater. Since it surely won't be said that the relationship of the Son to the Father is much closer than among humans, and less so for the Father to the Son. For if we admire the Son because he was obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross, and consider this the great wonder about him, we ought to admire the Father too, that he gave birth to such a Son, not as a slave under command, but as a free being, offering obedience and giving advice, because an adviser is not a slave. But again, when you hear of an adviser, do not infer that the Father is in need, but rather that the Son holds the same honor as him who sired him. Therefore, do not stretch the example of man and woman to all details. For indeed, the woman is reasonably subjected to the man in our society, since equality of honor can cause disagreement, and not just for this reason, but also because of the deceit that occurred in the beginning. Thus, you can see that she was not made subordinate as soon as she was created, nor, when God brought her to the man, did either of them hear such a thing from him, nor did the man say any such word to her. He indeed said that she was bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh, but he never mentioned about rule or submission to her. But when she misused her privilege, and she, who had been created to be a helper, was found to be a trap, ruining everything, that is when she is justly told for the future, "Your desire shall be for your husband." To account for this, it was probable that this sin would have plunged our race into a state of conflict. Therefore God, recognizing the malice of the devil, erected the defense of this word and the potential hostility from his wicked scheme. He eliminated by means of this verdict and by the desire embedded in us, in this way, tearing down the barrier wall, that is, the resentment caused by her sin. But in God and in that pure essence, one must not assume any such thing. Therefore, do not apply these examples universally, as this could lead to many serious errors. For instance, at the beginning of this same epistle, he said, "All are yours, and you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God." So then, are we all equally the possession of others as we belong to Christ and Christ belongs to God? Not in the slightest. Even the most simple among us can see the difference, even though the same expression is used for God, Christ, and us. Elsewhere, he also refers to the husband as the head of the wife, and then further explains this. Just as Christ is head and savior and defender of the church, so a man should be to his wife. So are we supposed to understand the statement in the text in the same way, including all that is written to the Ephesians on this subject afterwards? Absolutely not. That's impossible. Because although the same words are spoken about God and men, they don't carry the same weight in relation to God and men. The understanding must be different for these and those statements. However, we shouldn't interpret everything differently either, because otherwise it would seem as if they were randomly added and meaningless, providing us no benefit. But just as we shouldn't accept everything as the same, we also shouldn't completely reject everything. In order to better understand my point, I'll try to illustrate it with an example. Christ is referred to as the head of the church. If I were to not stray from the human interpretation of this term, I would question the purpose of this phrase. Conversely, if I were to fully invest in this human understanding, it would lead to utter absurdity. This is because the head, like the body, is subject to the same vulnerabilities and emotions. So what should we discard and what should we embrace from this? We should disregard the details I've mentioned, but interpret the concept of a perfect unity and the primary principle. However, we shouldn't strictly adhere to these ideas either. Instead, we should form our own comprehension of what is beyond our grasp and what is appropriate for God. For both the unity is more secure and the beginning more dignified. Again, you hear the word Son. Don't assume this includes everything in every case, yet you shouldn't reject everything either, but accept whatever is suitable for God, for example, that he is of the same essence, that he is of God. The things which are inappropriate and belong to human weakness, leave those on the earth. Again, God is referred to as light. Should we then accept all conditions that pertain to natural light? Not at all. For this light succumbs to darkness, is confined by space, is driven by another power, and is overshadowed, none of which it is permissible to even conceive about that essence. However, we won't reject everything for this reason, but we'll glean something beneficial from this example. The illumination that comes to us from God, the escape from darkness, this will be what we'll collect from it. Thus far, in response to the heretics, but we must also systematically go over the entire passage. Perhaps someone here may also have doubts, asking themselves what kind of crime it was for the woman to be uncovered, or the man covered. Learn what kind of crime it was from this point. Many different symbols have been given to both man and woman, to him of rule, to her of subjection, and among them this too, that she should be covered while he has his head bare. If these are symbols, you can see that both are mistaken when they disrupt the correct order and go against the arrangement of God and their own proper boundaries, both the man falling into the woman's inferiority and the woman rising up against the man by her outer garments. For if swapping of clothes isn't allowed, such that neither she should wear a cloak, nor he with a mantle or a veil, much more is it inappropriate for these things to be exchanged. For the former were established by people, even though God later endorsed them. But this by nature, I mean the being covered or uncovered. But when I say nature, I mean God, for he is the one who created nature. So when you overturn these boundaries, see how great the damages that follow are. And don't tell me that the mistake is just minor. For starters, it is significant in its own right, considering it as disobedience. Moreover, even if it were minor, its significance is amplified due to the importance of the things it signifies. However, its importance is clear given its powerful role in maintaining order among humans, ensuring both the leaders and the followers are rightfully maintained in their respective positions by it, so that he who sins disrupts everything and betrays God's gifts and throws down the honor given to him from above, not only the man but the woman as well. For to her also it is the highest honor to maintain her own position, as truly of all dishonors, behaving as a rebel is the worst. Therefore he established this rule for both by saying, Verse 4, any man who prays or prophesies with a covered head disgraces his head, but any woman who prays or prophesies with an uncovered head dishonors her head. For there were, as I mentioned, both men who prophesied and women who had this gift at that time, like the daughters of Philip, as others before them and after them. Regarding them, the prophet spoke in the past, your sons shall prophesy, and your daughters shall see visions. Well then, a man is not required to always be uncovered, but only when he prays. For every man, he says, praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head. However, a woman is commanded to be covered at all times. Therefore, having said, every woman that prays or prophesies with her head uncovered, dishonors her head, he didn't stop at only this point, but also went on to say, for it is the same as if she were shaven. If being shaven is always dishonorable, it's evident that being uncovered is always a disgrace. He didn't stop with just that, but added, the woman should have a sign of authority on her head because of the angels. This implies that a woman should be covered not only during prayer, but also continuously. As for the man, the discourse is no longer about covering, but about growing long hair. He only forbids a man to cover his head when praying, but discourages growing long hair at all times. Therefore, regarding the woman, he said, but if she's not veiled, let her also be shorn. Similarly for the man, if he has long hair, it's a dishonor to him. He didn't say if he's covered, but if he has long hair. That's why he stated at the start, every man praying or prophesying, having anything on his head, dishonors his head. He didn't say covered, but having anything on his head, implying that even if he prays with a bare head, having long hair makes him seem like he's covered. For the hair, he says, is given for a covering. But if a woman is not veiled, she should also be shorn. But if it is a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, she should be veiled. So in the beginning, he simply says that the head should not be bare. But as he continues, he implies both the persistence of the rule, saying, for it is the same as if she were shaven, and the careful adherence to it. He didn't just say covered, but completely covered, implying that she should be thoroughly wrapped up on all sides. By pointing out the absurdity, he shames them, severely reprimanding, but if she is not covered, she should also be shorn. It's as if he said, if you discard the covering set by God's law, also discard the one set by nature. But if anyone asks, no, how can this be a disgrace to the woman if she rises to the man's glory? We could respond with this, she does not rise, but instead falls from her own distinct honor. Since not staying within our own boundaries and the laws established by God, but exceeding them, is not an enhancement but a reduction. For as he who craves other people's possessions and takes what is not his own has not gained anything more but is diminished, having even lost what he had, so too the woman does not acquire the man's dignity, but loses even the woman's propriety which she had. And her shame and disgrace arises not only from this, but also from her greed. So, after acknowledging what is evidently disgraceful and saying, "But if it's shameful for a woman to have short or no hair," he suggests his own conclusion, saying, "She should be covered." And he didn't say, "She should have long hair," but, "She should be covered." Linking these two conditions as one, and establishing them in both ways, based on what's customary and their opposites, implying that both the head covering and the hair served the same purpose, and also that a woman who's shaved is effectively the same as one with a bare head. For it's the same thing, he says, as if she were shaved. But if anyone asks, how is it the same if one woman has natural hair, but the shaved woman doesn't even have that? We'd answer that, according to her intentions, she's also rejected her natural hair by leaving her head bare. And if her head isn't completely bald, that's due to nature, not her own actions. So just like a woman with a shaved head, this woman is uncovered in the same way. For this reason, he allowed nature to provide her with a covering so that she might learn from it to cover herself. Then he also provides a reason, as if he's conversing with those who are independent, a thing which I have noted in many places. So what is this reason? For a man should not have his head covered, because he is the image and glory of God. This is yet another reason. Not only, as he says, should he not cover his head because he has Christ as his head, but also because he is the ruler over the woman. For a ruler, when he stands before the king, should bear the emblem of his rule. Just as a leader would not dare to stand before a crowned king without his military belt and cloak, so should you not pray before God without the symbols of your rule, lest you disrespect both yourself and him who has honored you. And the same thing can be said about the woman. For her, too, it is a disgrace not to have signs of her submission. But the woman is the glory of the man. Therefore, the man's rule is natural. Then, after establishing his argument, he proceeds to present other reasons and causes as well, guiding you back to the original creation, and saying as follows, "For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. But if being of anyone is an honor to the one of whom one is derived, much more is being an image of him. For the man was not created for the woman, but the woman was created for the man." This is again another advantage, actually, also a third and a fourth, the first being that Christ is our head, and we are the head of the woman. A second, that we are the glory of God, but the woman is the glory of us. A third, that we are not from the woman, but she is from us. A fourth, that we are not for her, but she is for us. For this reason, women should have a sign of authority on their head. For this reason. Which reason, do you ask? For all of these that have been mentioned, he says, or rather, not only for these, but also because of the angels. For even if you disrespect your husband, he says, still respect the angels. It implies that being covered is a sign of subordination and power, as it encourages her to lower her gaze, feel humble, and fully maintain her respective virtue. For the virtue and honor of those ruled is to remain in their obedience. Again, the man is not forced to do this, as he is the image of his Lord, but the woman is, and that reasonably. Consider then the extent of the transgression when, being honored with such a high privilege, you disgrace yourself, adopting the woman's clothing. And you're doing the same as if, having been given a crown, you were to throw the crown from your head, and instead of it, wear a servant's garment. However, neither is the man independent of the woman, nor the woman independent of the man in the Lord. So, because he had given significant superiority to the man, having stated that the woman is of him, for him, and under him, he skillfully balances it out, ensuring neither the men are overly exalted, nor the women are depressed, by introducing the correction, saying, "However, neither is the man without the woman, nor the woman without the man, in the Lord." Don't just examine, he says, the initial things and that creation, because if you look into what comes after, each one of the two is the cause of the other, or rather not even just each of the other, but God of all. This is why he says, "Neither is the man without the woman, nor the woman without the man, in the Lord." For as the woman comes from the man, so too is the man born from the woman. He didn't say, of the woman, but he repeats the expression, of the man. For still this specific privilege remains complete with the man. However, these are not the man's qualities, but God's. Therefore, he also adds, but all things of God. So if all things belong to God and he commands these things, then comply and do not contradict. Verse 13. Determine within yourselves, is it appropriate for a woman to pray to God while uncovered? Further, he situates them as the judges of the expressed matters, as he did concerning the idol sacrifices. For just as there he says, determine what I am saying. In the same manner here, determine within yourselves. And now he implies something considerably more serious. For he states that the insult here extends upon God. Even so, he doesn't precisely articulate this, but in a more subtle and somewhat cryptic manner of communication, is it appropriate that a woman pray unto God unveiled? Verse 14. Doesn't nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? Verse 15. But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, because her hair has been given to her as a covering. His consistent habit of stating commonly accepted reasons is also seen here, applying the common custom, and significantly disconcerting those who expected to be taught these things by him, which they could have learned even from conventional human behavior. Indeed, even barbarians are not ignorant of such things. Notice how he consistently uses pointed remarks. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. And likewise, if a woman shaves or shaves her head, it is disgraceful, and she should cover her head. And here again, if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him. But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, because her hair is given to her as a covering. And if it is given to her as a covering, you say, why does she need to add another covering? This is so not only nature, but also her own will can play a part in her recognition of being subordinate. Nature herself passed a preemptive law stating you ought to be covered. Now, I ask, add your contribution so you don't appear to undermine nature's laws, displaying outrageous audacity not only towards us, but also nature. That's why God reprimanded the Jews, saying in Ezekiel 16:21-22, you have killed your sons and daughters. This is beyond all your abominations. And again, Paul scolds the impure among the Romans, making the accusation even harsher, saying that their behavior was not only against God's law, but even against nature, for they change the natural use into that which is against nature. Therefore, here also he uses this argument indicating this very thing, both that he is not setting up any odd law, and that among Gentiles their inventions would all be regarded as a kind of innovation against nature. So also Christ, implying the same, said, whatsoever you would like men to do to you, do so to them, showing that he is not introducing anything new. But if anyone appears to be argumentative, we don't have such a practice, neither do the churches of God. It is then argumentative to oppose these things, and not any exercise of reason. However, even so, it is a calculated sort of rebuke that he adopts, to fill them with more self-reproach, which indeed made his statement even more severe. For we, he says, have no such custom, so as to argue and fight and oppose ourselves. And he didn't even stop there, but also added, neither the churches of God, signifying that they resist and oppose themselves to the whole world by not giving in. However, even if the Corinthians were then argumentative, yet now the whole world has both accepted and maintained this rule. So great is the power of the crucified. But I worry that, despite adopting modest clothing, some of our women may behave improperly or immodestly in other ways. This is why Paul, writing to Timothy, wasn't satisfied with advising women to dress modestly, but added that they adorn themselves in modest apparel, with respect and self-control, not with elaborate hairstyles or gold. If a woman should always maintain an outward appearance of modesty, it's even more crucial for her actions to reflect this. The women of the past respected their husbands and yielded to them. But the men loved their wives, I hear you say, and I know that is true. However, when we are encouraging you to behave modestly, we should focus on women's duties, not men's. When we advise children to respect and obey their parents, as is written, honor your father and your mother, they may reply with, mention also what follows, and fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Similarly, when we instruct servants that they should obey their masters, not with service only when they are watching, they may demand that we advise masters to treat them rightly. They could point out that Paul also advised masters, give up threatening. We should resist this urge to focus on the duties of others. We must heed our own responsibilities first and foremost. You cannot shed blame for transgressions by sharing it with others. Adam blamed Eve, and Eve blamed the serpent, but this did not absolve them of guilt. Therefore, do not try to deflect your responsibilities to your husband. Remain focused on your duties and be cooperative with your spouse. If your obedience to your husband is truly for God's sake, do not concern yourself with your husband's duties, but commit yourself to your own responsibilities. Showing obedience under adversity is a true testament to your faithfulness. The one who loves a person, even when they are hated by them, is the one who truly deserves praise. Similarly, if your husband is hard to love and you endure it, you will receive a great reward from God. If he is gentle and easy to love, what does that really say about your commitment? I say this not to encourage harshness from the husband, but to encourage the wives to bear with their husband's faults. When each person is committed to fulfilling their own duties, their partner's improvement will naturally follow. A wife's patience towards her husband's harshness could inspire the husband to show restraint when his wife is irritable, resulting in a calm, peaceful relationship. In the same way, it was with those in the old days. Each one focused on fulfilling their own responsibility, not on demanding that of their neighbor. For example, Abraham took his brother's son. His wife didn't object. When he instructed her to go on a long journey, she didn't argue, but simply followed. Even after experiencing many hardships and struggles, and having become the leader of all, he gave precedence to Lot. Moreover, Sarah was not offended by this. She didn't even voice a single comment. She didn't complain or say such things as many women these days say when they see their husbands coming off as less in comparable situations, especially when dealing with those below them, criticizing them as fools, senseless, unmanly, traitors, and stupid. But Sarah never expressed or thought such things. She was content with everything done by him. And another thing, even greater. After Lot was given the choice and had imposed the lesser part upon his uncle, a major danger confronted him. When the patriarch heard about this, he prepared all his people and faced the entire Persian army alone with only his household. She didn't stand in his way or say anything like, "Oh, man, where are you going, risking your life and putting yourself in great danger for someone who wronged you and took everything you had, spilling your blood? Yes, and even if you don't care about yourself, at least think of me. I left my home, my country, my friends and family, and have accompanied you on this long journey. Don't leave me a widow and in the sorrow of widowhood." She didn't say a word. She didn't even think about it. She silently accepted everything. Following this, her womb remained barren. But she did not sorrow or grieve as women often do. Instead, he aired his grievances, not to his wife, but to God. Observe how each maintained their respective roles. He did not scorn Sarah for being childless, nor did he blame her for it. Conversely, she strived to provide him solace for her infertility through the maid. This was not yet forbidden at the time. Today, it is not permitted for women to allow their husbands such indulgences or for men to form such relationships, whether their wives know or not, even if they are deeply distressed by their inability to have children. For they shall receive the punishment. Their worm shall not die, neither shall their fire be quenched. Currently it is forbidden, but at that time it had not yet been prohibited. Therefore both Sarah commanded this, and he obeyed, but not for the sake of pleasure. However, some may point out how he expelled Hagar at Sarah's request. Well, this is what I want to highlight, that both of them obeyed each other in all matters. But don't just focus on these events, but also dig deeper into what happened before, such as Hagar's rudeness towards Sarah and her braggadocio against her mistress. What could be more aggravating for a noble and free woman? Then the wife should not wait for the husband's virtue before showing her own, for that isn't significant. Nor should the husband wait for the wife's obedience before exercising self-control. For this wouldn't be an admirable act either. But as I said, each should contribute their share first. For if we must turn the other cheek to non-Christians who strike us, we should tolerate even more a husband's harsh behavior. And I'm not saying this to justify a wife being beaten, far from it, because that's the absolute worst offense, not to the woman who is beaten, but to the man who beats her. But even if, unfortunately, you find yourself paired with such a partner, don't take it harshly, woman, considering the reward that awaits for enduring such things and the praise you'll earn in this life. And to you, husbands, I say this. Make it a rule to never allow any offense to push you to the point of hitting your wife. And why do I speak of a wife? Because not even on his maidservant could a free man bear to inflict blows and lay violent hands. But if it's shameful for a man to beat a maidservant, it's even more shameful to raise his hand against a free woman. Even heathen legislatures, you'll see, no longer force a woman who's been treated this way to live with the man who beat her, deeming him unworthy of her companionship. It's an absolute sign of extreme lawlessness when your life partner, the woman most closely and deeply connected to you, is treated like a lowly slave by you. Therefore, a man who does such a thing, if one can even call him a man, and not rather a wild beast, I'd say is like a parricide and a matricide. For we've been commanded to leave our parents for the sake of our wives, not to wrong our parents, but to follow a divine law. A law so dear to our parents themselves that they, the very people we're leaving, are grateful for it and eagerly support it. What kind of extreme madness, then, inspires someone to insult the woman for whose sake God asked us to even leave our parents? But we must indeed ask, is it only insanity? There is also the embarrassment. I'd like to know who can withstand it. And how can it be depicted when screams and laments echo down the alleys, and people, both neighbors and passers-by, rush towards the house of the person causing such disgrace as if a wild beast were rampaging inside? It would be better if the earth were to split open for someone so deranged, rather than having him appear at all in the public square afterward. But the woman is defiant, he says. Still, remember that she is a woman, the weaker vessel, while you are a man. This is why you were appointed as the leader, assigned to her as a head, to tolerate the weaknesses of the one who is under your authority. Therefore, make your rule magnificent. It will indeed be magnificent when it ensures that she, who is under your rule, is not dishonored by you. Just as a king will appear more dignified when he shows more dignity towards his subordinates. If he disrespects and diminishes their status, he is indirectly eroding a large part of his own glory. Similarly, if you disrespect her, who is second in command to you, you will significantly impair the honor of your rule. Considering all these factors, command yourself. And at the same time, also remember that evening when the father, having summoned you, handed his daughter over to you as a sort of trust and removed her from everyone else, from her mother, from himself, from the family, entrusting her complete care to your hand. Remember that through her you have children and have become a father, and for this reason be gentle towards her. Don't you notice the farmers, how they tend to the land which has received the seed, with various different methods of cultivation, despite it having numerous disadvantages, such as poor soil quality, weed infestation, or excessive rain due to its location? You must do the same, for you will be the first to enjoy both the fruit and the calm. Since your wife is both your safe haven and a powerful healing charm to lift your spirits. So, if you rid your safe haven of turbulence and unrest, you will enjoy great tranquility upon returning from the outside world. But if you fill it with discord and confusion, you only set yourself up for a more heartbreaking setback. To prevent this, I advise the following. When any discomfort occurs in the household, if she's at fault, console her and don't exacerbate the situation. For even if you were to lose everything, nothing is more dreadful than having a wife who doesn't share your residence with goodwill. If you list any offense, nothing you describe would be as painful as being at odds with her. Therefore, for reasons such as these, her love should be more precious than anything else. For if we are to bear each other's burdens, we must certainly bear our wife's. Even if she is poor, do not belittle her. If she is foolish, don't trample on her, but instead guide her. This is because she's part of you, and you two have become one. But she's trivial, drunk, and bad-tempered. You should then feel sorrow for these issues, not anger. You should pray to God, advise her, encourage her, and do everything possible to alleviate the problem. If you hit her, you're only worsening the condition. Hostility is best cured by showing restraint, not matching her intensity. Alongside these things, also remember the reward from God. Even when you have the option to leave her and choose not to out of respect for God, tolerating such serious flaws and adhering to the law that prohibits divorcing a wife no matter her faults, you'll receive an indescribable reward from God. Before this grand reward, you'll already benefit greatly as her obedience will increase and you, yourself, will become gentler as a result. For example, it's been said that a pagan philosopher who had an attitude-prone and argumentative wife, when asked, "Why do you tolerate her despite her shortcomings?" responded, "So I can have a school and a place of learning philosophy at home. I'll be more humble," he said, "being disciplined daily here." Did this make you rejoice? Well, I, at this very moment, am deeply saddened that pagans are showing more love for wisdom than us. We, who are asked to mirror the actions of angels, or better yet, expected to emulate God himself in terms of gentleness. Moving forward, I've heard it said that a philosopher kept his disagreeable wife and did not cast her away. Some even suggest he married her for that very reason. However, knowing that not all men operate on such rational thought, I suggest they make every possible effort to choose a suitable partner full of virtue. If it happens that they end up with a wife who isn't suitable or commendable, I then advise them to try and adjust, like the philosopher would, by educating her and prioritizing this above everything else. Just as a merchant would not venture into the deep sea without agreeing to peace terms with his partner, let's make every effort to maintain a peaceful atmosphere at home with our life partner. This ensures that all other aspects of our life remain peaceful as we navigate through life's challenges. Our family, servants, wealth, properties, and even matters of the state should be secondary in our considerations compared to the importance of having a supportive and unified partner in life. This equilibrium will help all aspects of our life flow smoothly, and we would find fewer obstacles in our spiritual pursuits. Bowing to the shared yoke in unity and performing our duties well will lead us to the blessings in store for us. We all attain these blessings through the grace and mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom, with the Father and the Holy Ghost, is due glory, power, and honor forever and always. Amen.